Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in to Red Ice TV. It's great to have you all here, wherever you're joining us from. If you're tuning in on YouTube or BitChute or through our websites, redice.tv or redicemembers.com, great of you to join us here today. We do have actually started to live stream these shows, if they are pre-recorded, on our DLive channel as well. So definitely make sure that you join us over there in case you want to check it out live. After the fact that it's been recorded, but we broadcast it live. And then, of course, it does have an archiving function there as well. And I do want to mention this because it's very important at this stage to actually branch out, and find different avenues. Because if there are parts of this interview today that, for whatever reason, we feel would end up in a territory which might be treacherous from YouTube's point of view, then we might have to snip that out. We might have to censor that, self-censor, so that we can continue to have our channel up. And if that is the case, then I'll put a little text down here whether or not we did edit. And then you guys can watch the full version on this either on BitChute or, as I say, we do live stream it afterwards to our Facebook, to Periscope, and to DLive as well. So definitely make sure you're subscribed to all these sources. And I mentioned this as well today because as the time of this recording on June 13th here, the Thursday, Black Pigeon Speaks was deleted from YouTube without virtually any notification. So this is what the future might hold. We don't yet know what's happened. I doubt he'll get the channel back. It was terminated for so-called hate speech. So we just want to kind of give a shout out to Black Pigeon Speaks and make sure that you follow him over on Twitter at Navy Hat O. And make sure that you subscribe to his BitChute as well. We'll drop a link to that in the description down below. And this might be the future now that we're looking at, because all of a sudden, for no reason, no proper response really from YouTube yet at this point as well. It's very important that we both support each other, make sure that everyone else knows where to find these guys as they're picked off one by one, kind of by YouTube. It's really sad, but it is the situation that we're looking at. So definitely make sure that you support Black Pigeon Speaks. And so that he can continue his work, whatever he decides to do moving forward here, if he decides to be on YouTube or not. Anyway, we have a great guest back with us on the show today, the Jolly Heretic, or Ed Dutton. Welcome back, Ed. It's great to have you here. You are, of course, with us. Let me pull this up now, February 27th, to talk about your other book, At Our Wits' End. We're talking about the collapse of IQs. It's great to have you back, Ed. Thank you for coming on again.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you.
You bet. Here's the page right there, guys. Definitely make sure you check it out. It was going down fairly well. People were liking it. It was about how dumb civilizations collapse, and it kind of was right in line with some of the stuff out of Idiocracy. But a great interview. Definitely make sure you check that out, guys. So today we're going to kind of branch out a little bit from this topic, and there are a number of books that are tangentially related to this as well, and one of them, Ed, is this one. Let me pull this up here. Race Differences in Ethnocentrism. Of course, now we're in tricky, volatile water here when it comes to YouTube. So we gotta tread lightly, Ed, forward, and see how we can approach this subject and talk about it in a good way, which is still allowed by YouTube. But anyway, introduce us to the book, Ed, and why you wrote this on these topics.
Well, I should say that I did a short video on this on my own YouTube page, The Jolly Heretic, and it was demonetized. And
there you
I
go.
Appealed. I appealed.
Yeah.
And they manually reviewed it and concluded that it was perfectly acceptable to their standards.
Well, good.
So perhaps we shouldn't have to be worried. But yes, Race Differences in Ethnocentrism. It's fascinated me for a long time. We often talk about this idea that all races appear to be more ethnocentric than Europeans, or at least that's how it seems at the moment. It may not have always been like that, but it seems like that. So what's going on? Why, first of all, is this the case? Is it objectively the case? And nobody seems to have really ever sort of systematically tested it. And if it is the case, of course, I was fascinated by why. And I became really interested in it in about 2015, when you had this, of course, this great migration, or the beginning of the so-called great migration, when all of these supposed refugees turned up on the shores of the Mediterranean claiming to be refugees and then started making their way through Europe. And of course, you have these fascinating differences in reaction from different countries. The attitudes of other Arab countries and also of Israel was, we're not going to take any at all, absolutely no way. even though, of course, they're very culturally and religiously similar to those countries. The attitude of the Western European countries, at least at first, was this virtue signaling frenzy. Angela Merkel saying, oh, you know, all of you come to Germany, and the Finnish Prime Minister Juha Sipilä saying, oh, come to Finland, and not only that, but I'll let you come and stay in my own house, which of course he never did, and encouraging encouraging elderly spinsters to let these men 21 pretending to be 14 to come and live with them, which actually happened. And of course Sweden, I mean, Finland took 32,000 of these refugees in that year alone, and then Sweden, which took per capita the largest number that any country did. But then of course the Eastern European reaction was completely different. The attitude of Viktor Orban, the attitude of Fico, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, and the attitude of all the other Poland, the other Eastern European countries, was absolutely not. No way. We're not letting these people here. It's going to undermine our culture. It's going to undermine our ethno-state. It's going to destroy us. We don't want this. And I thought this was really, really interesting. And so I wanted to test, first of all, is it the case that there are race differences, ethnocentrism? And secondly, if it is the case, how can we begin to make sense of this? And that was where the book that's how it germinated, really.
Interesting. So let's just dive right into that and talk about that and what you found and how you came to those conclusions. How did you go about studying this, looking at classic averages on DNA tied to geographical locations, or how did you go about it?
Yeah, so there were a number of methods that first of all, I did an academic paper in the journal Personality and Individual Differences with my colleagues Guy Madison and Richard Lynn, in which we looked at various social surveys, various survey methods, and were able from that to code based on questions, global survey and so on, how ethnocentric people were, how likely they were to make sacrifices for their country, how repelled, because there's two dimensions to ethnocentrism. One is positive ethnocentrism, the other is negative ethnocentrism. Positive ethnocentrism is that you see your people as the best and you're prepared to make sacrifices for them, that kind of thing. And negative ethnocentrism is that you don't like foreigners, you don't like people from other ethnicities and you see them as inferior. And so there were various questions on these various surveys of representative samples from different countries that we could use as a means of working out what national differences were in these kinds of attitudes. And then we could, of course, bring those together into racial groups. And on that basis, we found that the most positively and negatively ethnocentric people were the Northeast Asians. These were followed by Arab and South Asian peoples. These were followed by Africans, who were high in negative ethnocentrism, but not particularly high in positive ethnocentrism. And then there wasn't a big statistically significant difference between Europeans and Africans. So that was it. So that was the ethnocentrism spectrum, if you like. And then we were also able to look at the prevalence of various alleles, which are found to be associated at the individual level with ethnocentric attitudes, and see how they worked out. And again, these were very high among the Northeast Asians and very low among Europeans. We were able to look at other measures of ethnocentrism, which found that on certain measures, African Americans, for example, Africans are more ethnocentric, negatively ethnocentric, I mean, than are Europeans. And then we were able to look at the various, we were able to test for various causes, various factors, which seem to elevate or reduce positive and negative ethnocentrism. And these were quite interesting. So in terms of positive ethnocentrism, countries and races that were more positively ethnocentric tended to be higher in religiousness. They tended to have lower national IQ, which is, on the one hand, this could be because having a low IQ kind of makes you instinctive and less able to overcome your cognitive biases and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, it could simply be that having a low IQ makes you poor, and thus, for that reason, makes you more kind of instinctive and more wary of outsiders. And people with low IQs also tend to be less trusting. So this would, IQ correlates with trust. So that's another issue. Poverty was an issue because poverty would make people more kind of instinctive. It would make people more on edge, more stressed. And when you're stressed, if we are evolved to be ethnocentric or to be religious, which in times of stress, which in turn makes us more ethnocentric, then you would expect poverty to elevate this, particularly mortality salience, because this obviously elevates religiousness and also general kind of instinctive drives. People become more kind of on edge and instinctive with mortality salience. Low median age at the national level. These statistically predicted being positively ethnocentric. And then negative ethnocentrism was predicted by evidence of what's called a fast life history strategy. So that is to say, you have an, in biology, technology, we talk about a life history strategy. If you are an R strategist, you are evolved to basically to an unstable and easy environment. And because it's unstable, you live fast and die young. So you invest all of your energy in basically sex because you want to have as many children as you possibly can, as quickly as you can, as many people as you can, so the maximum number of your genes survive. As the ecology becomes more stable and more harsh, then the carrying capacity for the species is reached and members of the species start to compete with each other. And once this happens, then if you just have lots of children with lots of women and they're not particularly adapted to the ecology or can't learn much about the ecology, they could all just die if the winter's too harsh. And so the consequence is the people, it becomes an arms race to become increasingly adapted to the environment, increasingly aware of the environment, to increasingly understand the environment, and the whole ecology therefore slows down, and people move energy away from copulation and lots of children to a smaller number of partners with a smaller number of children, which they invest more energy in nurturing so that they can better survive the environment. And so in this K ecology that's stable yet harsh, where there's a future payoff, where you can predict the future and whatever, this selects for intelligence because intelligence is associated with time preference and being able to plan for the future. It selects for being cooperative because you learn better if you're cooperative, and also groups which are highly cooperative and high in impulse control and whatever are more likely to be cohesive groups, and they're more likely to kind of win in the battle of group selection against other groups. And so this selects what we call a K strategy, a more slow strategy. And ethnocentrism, being highly positively and negatively ethnocentric, seems to be a quite pronounced example, and religiousness as well, because it correlates with religiousness, of a K strategy, because it means that you are prepared to, you're strongly bonded with your group, the group is highly internally cooperative, you're prepared to make sacrifices for your group, all this kind of thing. That's positive ethnocentrism, that's a K strategy thing. And negative ethnocentrism, okay, you could argue it's an R strategy thing in the sense that it's being hostile to outsiders. But on the other hand, the more K strategy a group becomes, the more uncoupled, the more tight the niche is, the more uncoupled the aspects of K seem to become. And so it makes sense that at extreme K, you'd get what you see with basically a very cold and very stable Japan, China, which is high ethnocentrism, and it's been positive and negative. And it's been found in computer models that all else being equal, if you set up a grid, we know, and you make and you some and you put different colors, two different colors on the grid, two colored groups, and some will always cooperate with everybody, and some will only cooperate with people of a different color, and some will only defect with people of their own color, and so on. The strategy which eventually dominates the grid is ethnocentrism, i.e. cooperate with your own and repel outsiders. So that's fast life history strategy. This predicts negative ethnocentrism. Religiousness again. Cousin marriage, which is interesting. Because, of course, what cousin marriage will do is it will reduce the gene pool. And so this means that there's more of a difference between your group and another group.
Right.
And so if you get invaded by another group, then there's more genetically for you to lose. If England were to be invaded by Swedish people, Swedish people are relatively similar genetically to the English, and so we would lose a bit genetically, but not that much. If England was invaded by Bushmen, we would lose a great deal more because we're much more genetically different. So cousin marriage seems to reduce... seems to elevate negative ethnocentrism. There's some evidence that it wasn't statistically significant that it also elevates positive ethnocentrism, because of course if you marry your cousin, then a male can be cuckoldry becomes less of a problem. So in a society of if you have a society of low trust, there's Somalia or somewhere like that, or the Middle East, no one trusts anybody else. How can you create an ethnocentric society that will win in the battle of group selection? Well, one method is cousin marriage, because what cousin marriage does is it means that even if your child isn't yours, it's still probably quite closely related to you, so you may as well invest in it. And this in turn means that there's less jealousy between males over being cuckolded, so males are kind of more able to cooperate and trust each other, and so this helps to create a more trusting society. So you can see how cousin marriage would also elevate positive ethnocentrism.
Interesting.
As well as negative of ethnocentrism. These were really the key factors that seemed to predict it. And from that, we could start to look at race differences in it and try to understand in more depth kind of what was going on.
Now, before we get to that and see what your findings were there, and again, if there's a specific actually genes for this, as far as we can see them, if there's any trace of that, but primarily driver, we were talking about in the beginning there was essentially environment that for that change to take place. Was that, did I understand that correct? For the first, for
But the environment, then the environment will start to select for certain genetic qualities.
Right.
So once the environment changes, then you start to get selection for people being higher in these certain qualities.
So again, depending on where you are on the globe, and depending on what happens, it seems to develop traits according to those changing climate patterns. Then essentially, that's pretty interesting.
Yes. So what you get, is quite an interesting phenomenon. I found. So if you look at the most ethnocentric group, this would be the Japanese or the Chinese, the Northeast Asians, the highest in both positive and negative ethnocentrism. Now, what do you have with them? You have a situation where it is extremely cold historically, and it is extremely stable. So this means it's a strong K strategy, and you have to be very, very strongly selected to the environment. The only way you can be very strongly selected to the environment is by having a small gene pool, because, of course, if you deviate from the optimum selection to the environment, then you're just going to be killed. So you have a small gene pool, and this will make you more different from outsiders. So therefore, you can expect them to be relatively high in negative ethnocentrism because they've got a small gene pool, making them genetically quite different from outsiders. You also, in this kind of ecology, it then selects in certain ways in terms of the nature of the personality. So it will strongly select because it's the cooperative groups that are going to survive and get on and so on. So it's very strongly selects in favour of agreeableness and in favour of, which is, you know, altruism and empathy, in favour of conscientiousness, which is impulse control. It will select against a trait which we call openness, i.e. curiosity. And there's a certain DRD4 gene, and there's another one called the 5, there's various gene forms which are associated with basically curiosity and things like this. And the Northeast Asians are very low in these in terms of the percentage of the population that carry them. We looked at this, a paper I did with my Japanese colleague, Ken Yakura, on why the Northeast Asians win so few per capita Nobel Prizes. They're very low in this kind of in kind of curiosity, and so it's going to select in this way for this kind of personality, this very cooperative, you know, low in impulse control, thus a small gene pool, and so it will be high in ethnocentrism and in positive and negative ethnocentrism. That will defend itself. There is another way, of course, you could defend yourself. You could win the battle of group selection, even if you weren't particularly ethnocentric, and that's by having lots of geniuses. Having geniuses who come up with brilliant ideas, and these brilliant ideas benefit the group, and they allow the group to win in warfare and battles and so on. And as long as the level of ethnocentrism doesn't drop below a certain optimum, then that will potentially allow you to dominate even groups which are more ethnocentric. The genius strategy, I call it, and it's very much the strategy of Europeans. Now, this is a problem for Northeast Asians, because Northeast Asians, of course, because they have a small gene pool, their intelligence, their IQ range tends to be bunched. They don't have many people who are very low IQ, i.e. retarded or whatever, even though they don't have many people who have very high IQ. In much the same way, their personality range tends to be bunched. The difference between the nastiest Japanese person and the nicest Japanese person, if you like, is not very big compared to what it would be in somewhere like Europe. Now, what this means, because the gene pool is small, is they're very unlikely to produce geniuses, because geniuses combine outlier high IQ, which is any outlier is unlikely to happen with a small gene pool, combined with moderately low agreeableness and moderately low conscientiousness. And this means, as we discussed when I was last here, that they can come up with a brilliant idea, they can think outside the box, and they don't care about offending people, which brilliant ideas always will. Now, genius ideas will always offend vested interests. This is the problem with this in a country like Japan, historically, is first of all, these unlikely combinations are probably not going to happen anyway. And even if they did, the flip side of them, the flip side of the outlier high IQ person who is moderately psychopathic will be a low IQ person who's moderately psychopathic, and therefore a criminal, and therefore a person who will undermine the cohesion of the society in a society where cohesion and group selection and being tightly structured and agreeableness and getting on is so important, you see. So it's very difficult for them to produce geniuses. You follow?
Yeah, definitely.
So consequently, they don't. And the strategy is ethnocentrism, and they may have higher intelligence than us. Average intelligence is about 5 points higher than ours, but the level of per capita genius is minuscule. I mean, we've done analyses of this. It's down there on a par, if you look at Nobel Prizes per capita, with countries that have an IQ of about 90. Like
right.
Turkey or Romania.
Right.
And this is consistent with other studies that I've done with colleagues, which have shown that if you control for the IQ of a country, so if you only look at countries which have an IQ of at least 90, which takes in 98% of science Nobel Prizes, then basically measures of testosterone at a national level predict IQ. Predict Nobel Prize achievement. So it's testosterone.
Really?
It's testosterone. Yes. So it's no balls, no Nobel. It's you've got to pick. You've got to have it. And it's very interesting. And so if you look at a country like Finland, where I live, they have on all of these markers, they seem to have low levels of testosterone. They have low levels also of autism, of certain autistic traits, which tends to correlate with testosterone. They have relatively high levels of schizophrenia, and this tends to correlate with low testosterone. So these are important factors in why the Northeast Asians have this strategy of ethnocentrism rather than genius. If you move to the Europeans, then it gets a bit different. Then you have a situation where the gene pool is, of course, they're still highly intelligent, but the gene pool is larger, and this means there is the potential to there is selection for ethnocentrism and so on, but it won't be as strong. But there is the potential to have very low ethnocentrism, if that works as a strategy, and have these geniuses that come up with brilliant ideas. If you have relatively low ethnocentrism, as long as it's not too low, this allows you to trade. It allows you to be more open to other people and other people's ideas. It allows you to expand. It allows you to, let's say, take in something like, learn from other people and expand more. You make a larger polity. The group expands more and more. You win more and more. You throw up yet more geniuses. They come up with more brilliant inventions that help you win wars and whatever.
Right.
And then you expand and expand and expand, and you can kind of dominate the globe. Which, of course, Europeans did, and particularly the British and the French and other empire nations. We've got a situation now. Look how many people there are in the world that are essentially British. It's not just the people that live in Britain who are the natives. It's a lot of white Americans, a lot of most white Canadians, white Australians, New Zealanders. Even within India and places like this, you've got these Clines that are their own a separate sort of social class, that are a sort of a ethnic group, really. The Anglo-Indians that are that have manifested. Or indeed among black people in America. So you have this massive group which expands its gene pool and basically wins the battle for its genetic future.
Now, so genius, let me ask you this, Ed, before you go on. So does that mean that genius also always kind of works? Well, I guess it's up to the group to make sure to harness those properties so that it works for the ethnic group, for the interests of the ethnic group, because otherwise you could have people that are super smart, but they don't have an interest in working for issues which would advance the ethnic group, right?
Indeed, I think that's very important. So you can look at different ways of passing on your genes. You can pass on your genes directly after having children. You can pass on your genes at the level of the kin, such as looking after your nieces and nephews, that kind of thing. And you can look after your genes at the level of the ethnic group. And it's been shown by research by Frank Salter that these ethnic groups are basically extended genetic kinship groups, essentially.
Yeah.
And so that's what geniuses, I argue in my book, that's what they are. They are group selected. They're operating at the level of the group. Indeed, often they don't have children. And they are these very unusual sort of people. They're not interested in sex. It's almost as if they repress their sex drive and they focus it into their genius work. And indeed there's a guy called Unwin, J.D. Unwin, who argued in a book called Sex and Culture that the repression of sex is very important. And recently there's been some research which has shown that people that repress sex because they feel it's dirty or something and taboo become seemingly as a consequence more creative. So there's something to be said for doing that. But yes, that's what geniuses are doing. They're operating at some of them have children, of course, but they're operating at this group level. And they're aiding the group. They're aiding the genetic interests of the group. And so what we can start to say is that as long as the level of ethnocentrism doesn't drop too low, as long as it remains optimally high or not, as an optimum low level of ethnocentrism, then you're fine. And that is the case under pre-industrial conditions, and even under even under industrial conditions to a certain degree, the level of ethnocentrism doesn't drop too low. However, as I explore in the book, there are a number of issues that have messed this up. The problem is it has dropped too low. Why has it dropped too low? Because these geniuses and the societies they come from have created standards of living that are so high that the consequence is that, well, a number of things have happened. First of all, levels of stress have dropped so low and levels of mortality salience have dropped so low that religiousness has started to collapse. And as we see, religiousness is a key factor in ethnocentrism. People who are traditionally religious are more likely also to be positively and negatively ethnocentric. But yet traditional religiousness is what seems to underpin it is stress. People are more religious at times of stress, and particularly when there's mortality salience. And so when these go down, then of course the consequence is that the level of ethnocentrism goes down. The second problem is that there's a degree to which we have a kind of cognitive bias to be ethnocentric, a genetic similarity theory. J. Philip Rushton looks at this. We have a cognitive bias to act positively and negatively in our genetic interests. And we're more likely to be subject to our cognitive biases when we are under a certain degree of ecological stress. But of course, this has now gone down to such an extent that we're not really subject to them to any great degree anymore. The third issue is that under conditions of Darwinian selection, the child mortality rate was about 40%. So every generation, 40% of babies that were born didn't reach adulthood, and this would and didn't pass on their genes. And then even among those that did reach adulthood, there'd be lots of them that wouldn't pass on their genes. And those would be the people that were physically sick, basically, that had a high mutational load. And every generation, Darwinian mutations were almost always bad, and every generation, Darwinian selection was purging society of these various mutant offspring that were born. That's quite understandable, and that was what was going on.
Yeah.
Now, with the Industrial Revolution, of course, you get the rise of better medicine, you get better conditions, you get the society is wealthier, you get this larger welfare state and safety net, you get inoculations, all this kind of thing. And even Charles Darwin commented on the fact that this was brought in was bound to mean a reduction in what he called the quality of the population. So you have all these people that would have died who are going to have suboptimal immune systems, who are going to have high mutational load, having children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and passing on their genes. And this is where it gets quite interesting, because there is a correlation between disorders of the mind, which are normally significantly genetic, and which, like autism or schizophrenia or paedophilia or whatever, disorders of the mind, which reflect mutant genes affecting the mind, and disorders of the body. Paedophiles, for example, are more likely to have attached earlobes. People who have, if you look at that Swedish girl, Greta Thunberg, she's the climate campaigner. She's
Thunberg.
And she has this extremely dysmorphic face.
Yeah, something looks very off with her. I can't put my finger on it.
Yes, she looks almost like she has fetal alcohol syndrome, and indeed I wonder if she might. But she probably, let's assume she doesn't have fetal alcohol syndrome. It could simply be a manifestation of autism. Autism involves something going wrong in development, going wrong in the brain at an early stage, due to mutant genes or whatever, and this is reflected, therefore, in the whole body. And in her case, it's reflected you can see it in the face, that she has a very small philtrum, and she has these narrow eyes and a very small nose, she doesn't seem to have gone through puberty yet, despite being 16 years old, and these various things. So this is what goes on. They tend to go together. If you have problems with the mind, they correlate with problems. Mutant genes in the mind, they correlate with mutant genes in the body, which makes sense, because the mind is about 88% of the genome. It's that complex. It's about 88% of all our genes relate to the mind. So it's a massive target for mutation. So obviously, if you've got something wrong with your body, if you've got a poor immune system, if you've got some genetic disease or whatever that makes you less likely to survive under Darwinian conditions, it seems extraordinarily likely that you'd have something wrong with your mind, because the mind is 88% of the genome. It's a huge target for mutation, you see. So what that means is that as we've had a rise in more and more and more people that wouldn't have survived under Darwinian conditions, who have suboptimal genetic physical health, you're going to get more and more people that have suboptimal genetic mental health. And this is going to include people that have what my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee has called spiteful mutations, i.e. mutations which cause you to think in a maladaptive way, to essentially have maladaptive instincts, which under Darwinian conditions would of course destroy you. Things like antinatalism, not wanting to have any children. Things like nihilism, believing life is pointless and we should all kill ourselves. Things like atheism. And interestingly, I've got a paper called The Mutant Says in His Heart There Is No God, where I show that religiousness, which, by the way, was selected for under evolutionary conditions, we know that, it's 40% genetic, it correlates with fertility, it correlates with physical and mental health. There are identifiable parts of the brain that are associated with it. And it's a human universal. So it's definitely something that was selected for under Darwinian conditions. Religiousness, even now, it correlates with all these adaptive things. Atheism correlates with the opposite. People who are atheists, and interestingly, people who are religious have more symmetrical and physically attractive faces, whereas atheists have more asymmetrical and physically unattractive faces, which shows, of course, that there's more mutant genes in the face, or there's an immune system which is bad, which means that they've been unable to maintain a symmetrical phenotype in the face of disease that life's had to throw at it. So what this means is you've got basically the rise of these spiteful mutants with these maladaptive ideas, and these will include things who will undermine the structures of society which promote it being ethnocentric, such as religiousness, such as the army and patriotism and whatever, such as the education system, and they will go for those things. They will be programmed to go for those things and undermine them because they have a genetic death wish. That's their purpose. That's what they will, of course, be selected out under Darwinian conditions. But those conditions have gone. Those conditions haven't been there intensely since 1800, and they haven't really been there at all for the last 50 years or so. And so they will go for those things, and they will undermine them, and they will thus make even non-carriers of these spiteful mutations, even relatively genetically normal people, become maladaptive. Because if you think about it, we're a highly cohesive, complex society, a bit like a beehive. We're all optimally intermingled together. And if you have some mutant who is in the feeder caste, and she gives too much food to this bee, this baby bee, and too little to this, and too much to this, you're going to get too many queens and not enough drones and too many workers and whatever. And this will result in the whole superorganism, the whole hive, being maladapted. And that's what's happening, I argue, to us. We have these mutants, and they are able to cause those who are even quite genetically normal to behave in a suboptimal way. Genetically suboptimal way, such that they don't behave, such as they're a woman and they are induced with feminism to delay their fertility till their mid-30s and they can't have any children. This would be an example of someone who is perhaps genetically quite normal but easily indoctrinated, but otherwise quite normal, and she's made maladaptive by these mutants within her midst who are able to get into these positions of power.
But it means that there are these individuals that are, let's say, let's call them borderline then, in the sense that if they were living in a society which was still, interested in looking after its own interest and moving forward, having kids and all these things, yes, maybe they would have adapted to those conditions and they would have been fine, essentially. But what's happening now, due to the amount of amount of people that we have, I think it's overpopulated, is kind of that these borderline cases are brought down with the other ones that you're talking about, the mutants, right? And essentially, and I think I brought this up last time, Ed, but yeah, go ahead if you want to jump in on there.
The mutants, I was just going to say, there's probably more of them than there used to be, these mutants, and they have more power, and they undermine the structures of society which encourage ethnocentric behavior or whatever to a greater degree. And so there'd be people now that, had they been born in the 60s, they would probably have ended up having children. But they were born in the 80s, and so they don't, because the power of these maladaptive ideologies over their lives has been stronger. So I may have brought it up last time, but that's another aspect then to why ethnocentrism has fallen in European countries, particularly low. And it means that, of course, once that's happened, our intelligence, our high intelligence, can essentially be weaponized against us, because intelligence is associated with trust, it's associated with openness, it's associated with liking new things, it's associated with cooperativeness, it's associated with altruistic attitudes. And so this means that if you have an ideology of immigration or whatever, then of course you're going to say, come in. It would be rather akin to, if we've kind of made ourselves into a zoo, and it would be rather akin to letting animals, you know, from the wild, really, into that zoo, because those people have been under conditions of Darwinian selection until more recently, and so they are more adapted to survival. So then you move beyond the English or the Europeans, and you would have then the South Asians, the Arab countries, and what you have there, which you used to have, of course, in Western countries to a greater extent, which promotes ethnocentrism, is patriarchy. Patriarchy means that males can trust each other. Essentially, it means that there's no problems, there's no fighting over. Women are controlled, women are veiled, women are under control, and therefore, if you can be more sure, if that's the case, that you're female, you're not cuckolded because your female is controlled and she's veiled, and this kind of thing. So this is why patriarchy becomes important. It's a way of ensuring that you're not cuckolded, and so it allows men to cooperate better and create a more ethnocentric kind of a society. Religiousness then promotes this patriarchy as the will of God. So you have the religiousness, which elevates their ethnocentrism, and in particular patriarchal religiousness. As the society gets less stable again, and as we move into Africa and places like this, you start to get things like female genital mutilation, of course. And this helps in terms of ethnocentrism, again, indirectly, because it means that you can be more sure that you're not going to be cuckolded and so on. And so you have this, the religiousness becomes key here, and also the fact that they're highly instinctive and very poor. And then eventually you move down to Africa, and in some parts of Africa, the level of negative ethnocentrism can be quite high, but the level of positive ethnocentrism can be quite low, because again, levels of trust and cooperation are just so low, and people tend to fission and whatever. So therefore, your levels of ethnocentrism here, positive, are not that high, really. But people are going to be sceptical of outsiders because they're all going to be quite different from each other, because they're all going to break a bunch of little tribes. And then in the most extreme cases, you get a situation in a very, very unstable ecology indeed, where you would expect very low ethnocentrism there. Because if it's very, very unstable, then what do you do? You want to pass on your genes. As a man, you're going to sexually select for women who are good-looking and young and fertile. Within that context, if you select for someone that's quite genetically different from you, then that might have some benefit to the offspring. They might have some unusual gene that might conceivably help. And so with people that, when it's very unstable, then you'll get people that will be more inclined to marry people who are quite genetically different from them. And that's really and you can see that. I mean, for example, a very unstable environment, someone like the Bushman, that's perhaps one of the most unstable and primitive peoples that there are. And so it perhaps shouldn't be a surprise that there's that group, what are they called, the Rohafbasta, who are a combination of Dutch settlers who went AWOL and Bushman. And so, yeah, that's really the gamut of it. So, yeah.
But let me ask you about unstable ecology and what we can classify that as, essentially, because I'm thinking now as things are changing. Let's take Scandinavia, right? It's a classic example where it's been, yes, it's cold and all that kind of stuff. So we understand that there's other, you know, there's driving factors there to time preference and planning ahead and those kinds of things. But in terms of like, otherwise, there's no like massive earthquakes and, you know, these kinds of things. There's no volcanoes. It's a very stable environment overall. But now we're getting societal transformations, and I'm wondering how we as humans would react to that. Can we bring that into the sense of that that's now our environment around us? Like we, even though if you live in a city or whatnot, I mean, you're still not obviously completely cut off from nature. But as trust gets lower, as there's massively more, it's more crime-ridden, especially in Sweden these days, than it was just 15, 20 years ago. I've seen this transformation take place, and so I'm thinking of, is that, do you think, would be considered to be unstable in the, I guess, unconsciously by most people in Sweden these days? And would that drive a change, consequently, to make them more ethnocentric?
Well, yes, this is from the perspective, perhaps, of some of your viewers, the happy ending to my book. Because what I argue is that although we are now in a situation where Europeans are particularly low in ethnocentrism, it's unlikely to always, it's going almost certainly to change. And it's going to change for a number of reasons. First of all, as I discussed in the last video here, we are becoming less intelligent. So this means that the Europeans who are breeding are those with low IQ. And low IQ predicts high negative ethnocentrism and to some extent positive ethnocentrism. The second group of, among Europeans who are breeding are people who are extremely religious among Europeans. And this again predicts high positive and high negative ethnocentrism. So those who are breeding are likely to make the society in the future much more ethnocentric, Europeans, I mean, than it is now. Thirdly, as you say, the very fact of that we've got this low in ethnocentrism has led, in effect, to a kind of invasion, because we have these spiteful mutants saying promoting multiculturalism and people being inculcated into it, and thus them coming into our homelands. And what this, of course, results in is a breakdown in trust. There's research by Putnam which has shown that basically the more multicultural a society is, trust levels will tend to collapse. And there's tension. And this book by Tatu Vavnin, which has showed that 66% of conflicts worldwide, the key issue is ethnic diversity. So ethnic diversity leads to basically low-level war. Of course, once that happens, you are in an R situation, and people are higher in stress. If they're higher in stress, they become more religious, which makes them more ethnocentric. They also become more ethnocentric in general because they are higher in stress. As the society becomes less intelligent, more things are going to stop working and things are going to break down and things won't be as easy. This will elevate stress and it will elevate religiousness. You also have the certain white groups within the society who feel excluded, who feel thrown on the scrappy, the white working class, the Brexit voter in the UK. Yeah. And those people, one of the predictors of religiousness and also instinctiveness is feeling excluded as well. So all of these things, I argue in the book, are going to gradually come together to mean that although things will get, as it were, better for those who are nationalistic, undoubtedly, for all of these reasons, Darwinian selection is going to reassert itself gradually. The hospital system will get worse, healthcare system will get worse, everything will get worse, so that we will be in a more R-selected situation.
Right.
That is definitely happening. It's people who are more K who are breeding, but it's what that is confounded by is the fact that its religiousness is often parallel with K in these studies. It's religious people who are breeding. In terms of the future genetics of Europeans and in terms of the future likely environmental conditions, we will become more ethnocentric once again.
So that means we'll just be right back on track, essentially, where we used to be, nature-wise.
I wouldn't like to say that, because okay. We will have collapsed down probably considerably more than even we are have collapsed now. I mean, we will be down in a situation where Darwinian pressures are stronger than they are now, where things are working less, there's war and there's conflict and there's things not working properly, and our standards of living are basically lower than they are now. Mortality salience is higher. These are what is going to happen in a society of declining intelligence quotient and of rising ethnic diversity, because ethnic diversity always leads to conflict and stress and whatever. So it's not a, in the short, in the medium term, it's going to be not very nice. But in the long term, yes, we would, as you say, get back on track.
Interesting. So, you know, again, I made this point last time you were on as well, but, you know, I still kind of see us still part of the clutches of nature, and nature always finds a way. Now, whether this is a short shortcut there, or whether, you know, if you want to quantify this as actually being nature essentially intervening, the end result is very much going to be the same, I think. It's almost like we took a detour, maybe partially due to our success to a certain extent, right? And then eventually it's an awful, awful detour to take. But at the end, as far as I see it, nature always wins, Ed. There's no way we can't escape it, right?
Yes, I argue in the other book, Wit's End, we history tends to be cyclical, and in terms of the rise and fall of intelligence, and perhaps indeed the rise and fall of ethnocentrism and religiousness, because what you find at the heights of these previous civilizations that collapse is because they're so high in luxury and stability and whatever, they become less. And they become less ethnocentric, and then you get these migrations, and you get what they would call decadence, and then the society collapses down because of that and those factors, those three factors. And then, of course, the people that are left are those that are low in intelligence and high in religiousness, and thus high in, as it were, ethnocentrism. And then this makes them motivated and whatever, and they have a sense of their own importance and their own destiny, and then the society rises up again.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's how I would say that.
Fascinating. We're going to take a break here in just a minute or two. And, of course, I want to talk more about this and go through if there's other interesting research in your book. But let's plug it a little bit here and let people know how to get it. Obviously, we did have the Amazon link up. Do you have it available anywhere else? I know that there's a lot of people that do want to not buy from Amazon anymore due to their behavior.
Well, you can buy it from the directly from the publishers, which is based in London.
Arctos?
Arctos, yep. Yes.
Excellent. So we can go to arctos.com.
I would suggest you, if you're based in Europe, then you might as well do that rather than buy it from Amazon.
Absolutely, do that. Yeah, do that. And do you lose out more on if people buy it on Amazon as well?
I would imagine so. I don't know, but I would imagine so. They must charge something. And then also, if you're in America, I don't know what the distribution like for Arctos is in America, but I get the impression that someone in America that reviewed my book got it very quickly. So I think Arctos must have an American distributor.
Yeah, we'll have it.
Canada, you can order it again through Arctos.
Excellent. We'll definitely have that link up, guys, because I know we got to start not supporting these monster behemoths like Amazon. I know people do it for convenience and all that stuff, but I'm happy to provide you guys with the Arctos link and get it straight through there. So race differences in ethnocentrism. Very interesting. You've done some really good videos lately too. I like the outfit you had in your latest video there, Ed.
Did you find yourself attracted?
No, I find myself very much disgusted. But it was funny though. I enjoyed it. I was laughing quite a bit actually. That's right. Yeah, gender dysphoria. No, it's good. It went down pretty well too. 11,000 views, so that did very good. Guys, check it out if you haven't already. Ed Dutton is still on YouTube, like we are for now. So subscribe while you can. Do you have a BitChute too, by the way? Set up.
I do. I do. If you put Edward Dutton into BitChute, you'll find most of those videos transferred over there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. Perfect. Yeah, we need those options. And of course, as well, I do want to mention that you do have a Patreon that helps out your research as well. So you can continue with that. We'll have a link up to that.
I have a Subscribestar as well, and you can also on PayPal if you want.
Excellent. So, okay. Wonderful. Well, thank you. First part here, that just went by really, really quick. A lot of interesting material. I have a lot more to ask you about, and we'll see if we can squeeze in as well, talking a bit about this book, The Silent Rape Epidemic, how the Finns were groomed to love their abusers. Very interesting. I haven't read up too much about the book yet, so I'm looking forward to, let me pull it up here, there it is, looking forward to hearing more about that as well. But yeah, stay with us everybody, stay with us, and we'll be right back after a short break. We'll be back in part two after this. That's part one with Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic. Definitely make sure you check out part two. Excellent continuation coming up here. We're going to talk a bit more about how his academic work has been received, some of the issues when it comes to race, and how the mainstream academic field, scientific field, views this question. And we're going to kind of just debunk over some of the just ridiculous claims that we're kind of getting from, especially from mainstream and popular science these days, too. If you look at anything on YouTube these days and do a search for race or is race real or something like that, you basically get a slew of garbage scientific work that basically is not objective. It just takes in all the political mumbo jumbo, and it doesn't give us the real facts about the reality of race. So that's an interesting question to discuss. We're also going to move on and talk about his other book, The Silent Rape Epidemic, How the Finns Were Groomed to Love Their Abusers. Is a fairly recent released book. It comes in the wake of a rape scandal and an epidemic in Oulu in Finland. And we're going to talk about, kind of how that began and what triggered that, and also some of the reactions of the Finns and the people. Kind of explain the psychology, really. And this applies to Swedes, to Norwegians, to a certain extent to Danes. I think in Denmark, they probably are a little bit more skeptical of kind of open borders and immigration, and at least are willing to have a discussion about Islam, although the circumstances in Denmark is definitely not ideal in that regard. But anyway, the Finnish-Swedish situation very much overlaps in that sense, and we'll talk about just what the mentality is and how whites led to these kinds of Rotherham situations, if you know what I mean, and how this came to Finland, and then also what's going to happen as that reaches a tipping point, as the wider population begins to denounce essentially multiculturalism and open borders, and just how quickly the change is going to occur in these countries once it becomes to a certain extent socially acceptable to be a critic of multiculturalism, of open borders, of this experiment that's happening right now. So that's a very interesting discussion coming up here in part two. So if you want to check that out, please head on over to redicemembers.com. Support us, sign up for a membership, best way to support us. Try it out for 3 months. If you like it, continue your subscription. Get a recurring one every 3 months, or get one that's 9 months, 6 months. We have all the way up to 2 years, 1 year, 2 years. And of course, the longer subscription you get, the cheaper the prices as well per month for that. So definitely check it out. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back, of course, with Flashback Friday, live 5 p.m. Eastern. That's 2300 hours or 11 p.m. Central European time. Then over the weekend, as usual, we have Weekend Warrior exclusive for redicemembers.com. Check out our t-shirts as well, redice.tv/store. We have a lot of things there for you, some great merch, good quality, organic, super comfy, some of the best t-shirts out there, I'd say. So definitely check that out. So thank you, guys. We'll be back with much more soon. Until then, much love to all of you. We'll see you soon.